This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be looking at the future of driving, how to prepare for a world full of electric cars. But first, this week, President Trump signed Space Policy Directive 1, directing NASA to make plans for returning American astronauts to the moon.
We will not only plant our flag and leave our footprint, we will establish a foundation for an eventual mission to Mars, and perhaps someday to many worlds beyond.
The directive, however, does not allocate any new funding for the effort, and it's not clear how much of the national space policy it will actually change. Here to talk about that and other short subjects in science is Annalee Newitz. She's the tech culture editor at Ars Technica in San Francisco. Welcome back, Annalee.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what is the take-home message about this moon proposal?
Well, it sounds really great. It's always good to have a president, especially one who's been so anti-science, saying something positive about scientific exploration. But we have heard this from presidents before. Both the Bush presidents promised we'd be going back to the moon. And the fact is, if, you know, there's no money being given to NASA to do this, it's going to be very difficult. You know, we're talking about maybe needing billions of dollars more to speed up the process of going to the moon. So I think this is a situation where, you know, we'll believe it when we see some funding.
Yeah, so it's just basically words. Words are cheap now, is what you're saying. Talk is cheap.
Talk is cheap, but it always sounds good to be talking about going to space.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to elsewhere in Washington. Regarding yesterday, the FCC voted to overturn the net neutrality rules that had been in place under the Obama administration. Where does that go from here? Is there going to be pushback on this?
Absolutely. And we've already heard a lot of talk, especially from state attorney generals, the New York State Attorney General, Washington State Attorney General. They're being joined by a number of other attorney generals to challenge this in court. They will probably be filing for an injunction and filing a court case within the next couple of weeks. And so this is going to be a long, drawn-out court process before we actually see these rules suspended, as Ajit Pai had promised.
Is there anything that Congress can do here if it doesn't like it?
That's also in the works. We've heard that some Democrats in the House are interested in introducing legislation that would formalize the rules of net neutrality, which had up until this point just been a regulatory framework. So that's another possibility. So we're going to see this playing out in the courts, possibly playing out in Congress, and it's going to be a long, long fight. And hopefully people will learn more about net neutrality along the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a fight for decades now, so just move it on the next pace. Let's move on from policy. There are new findings about a Neolithic weapon. Whoa, what does that mean?
That's right. This is a Neolithic forensics mystery. When we look back at the Neolithic period, which is in the UK and Western Europe, that's about 4,000 years ago to about 3,000 years ago, there's a number of terrible crimes that took place. And archaeologists have found evidence of massacres where whole villages, men, women, and children, were killed with blunt force trauma to the skull. And this kind of trauma leaves a very characteristic kind of injury where there's a kind of depression in the skull with a spider web of cracks kind of coming out of it. And archaeologists have wondered, what kind of weapon were people using for human-on-human violence, as opposed to the kinds of range weapons like spears that they might use on animals? So a number of years ago, archaeologists in the UK found a possible culprit, and it's a weapon that they called the Thames Beater. And it's a wooden club that looks astonishingly like a cricket bat. It's a club with a kind of flattened oar-like end. And so two archaeologists this week described in Antiquity magazine how they did an experiment to figure out whether the Thames Beater was responsible for some of these ancient crimes.
Wow. You know, maybe that Thames Beater, somebody picked it up and hit it with a little round ball sometime and discovered, hey, there's something better than hitting a person with it.
What the archaeologists did was they recreated human skulls using plastic and ballistics gel. So they basically had plastic balls full of goo to imitate human brains. Yeah. And then they recreated a Thames beater and smashed these fake human skulls to see if it would leave the same kind of damage. And it did. So it looks like the Thames beater was responsible for these ancient murders. And it's interesting because it gives us a look at how people looked at interpersonal violence 4,000 years ago. This is a very intimate weapon. You know, you had to get in close to someone to really do damage. And so to kill someone else, you kind of took your life in your own hands. So it's interesting. It's an interesting window on how violence worked long ago between people. Mm.
On a more peaceful level, there's research into anesthetics in plants. Tell us about that.
It turns out that plants can be made unconscious, essentially, using anesthesia. A group of scientists exposed a number of plants, but most interestingly, a Venus flytrap, to ether. They basically took a Venus flytrap, stuck it in a bag with some ether gas, and exposed it for a while. And once it had been anesthetized, when the scientists would touch the trigger hairs on the Venus flytrap, that's the thing that makes the trap close up really fast, the trap would no longer close. So effectively, the Venus flytrap was unconscious, and the effects wore off after about 15 minutes. And the thing that was super interesting about this was, well, first of all, it means that plants can become unconscious, which raises all kinds of questions about plant consciousness. Mm. But in terms of its applicability to humans, it turns out that plants are becoming unconscious almost the same way animals do, because what this anesthesia does, and ether is just one kind of anesthesia that does this, is it depresses the electrical signaling between cells. It basically causes less electricity to flow between cells, which creates a kind of paralysis. So now we know that both animals and plants can be subject to this kind of process with anesthesia. So it does mean, I guess, that you can make your wiggly plants a little more still, but also it gives us insight into how anesthesia works, yeah, which is still kind of a mystery.
It is cool. And one day, Annalee, we're going to discuss consciousness in plants, so be prepared for that.
I am eager to do that.
Annalee Newitz is a tech culture editor at Ars Technica in San Francisco. Thanks for being with us today, and holiday greetings to you.
Yeah, happy Hanukkah.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. If you've looked around your neighborhood lately, it's a big time of the year for outdoor lighting, right? But outdoor lighting is now big all year. Everybody wants these new LEDs. They use much less electricity. But they may have a dark side. Here to help sort through the good and bad of LED lighting is Lori Allen, director of the Kitt Peak National Observatory in Tucson. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira. It's great to be here.
Oh, you're welcome. Now, everybody loves LED lighting. It uses so much less energy, and that's a good thing. So what's the problem?
Sure. Everybody loves them because they are, of course, energy efficient and very affordable, and they last a very long time. The problem is that the early generation LEDs contain a huge amount of blue light relative to other kinds of light from the visual spectrum. And that blue light has a lot of consequences. For one thing, it's most efficiently scattered into the sky, and so it actually brightens the sky background and makes it harder for us to detect faint galaxies on the sky. More importantly, blue light has been found to be bad for you. Now, that's why on your cell phone screen and your laptop screen, you probably have a program that runs after dark, blocking some of the blue light emitted from your screen and turning your screen a little bit of an orangey tint.
Yeah.
And what happens is that, you know, the blue light suppresses melatonin production. And melatonin is a super important hormone, you know, that regulates your body's internal clock. And so it can disrupt your sleep, and there's growing evidence, according to the American Medical Association, that this could be linked to all kinds of health problems like obesity, diabetes, and cancer. Mm-hmm. The blue light is also very bad for wildlife. Most of the mammals on the planet are nocturnal, and they actually need the dark in order to thrive. And it's just unpleasant. Many of your listeners will have looked at some of these newer blue light LED streetlights, and they'll find that they're very hard on your eyes, much like the super blue, super intense headlights that you sometimes encounter sort of temporarily blind you.
Mm. So give us some advice, anything that people can do.
Yeah, there are several things people can do, and they're pretty straightforward. The first thing that everybody can do, whether it's a street light or a light on their patio or back porch, is to shield that light. The light should only go down onto the ground where you need it, not up into the sky or horizontally out across the landscape. When you illuminate just the area that you need, you'll find that you can save energy and money because you actually need less wattage. This will also reduce glare. You know, you don't have bare bulbs inside your house. You typically cover those with a lampshade because if you look directly at the bulb, the glare makes it actually hard to see. And finally, it will make you a better neighbor if you shield your outdoor lights. And, light trespass onto your neighbor's property can be a real problem.
Yeah, well, you might suspend it for the holiday season, though, with all that lighting out there.
Well, yeah, I won't grouse at people for their holiday light decorations, but if they mount a blue LED wall pack on an outdoor shed that shines into my light, I might get a little grumpy.
Me too.
There are other things.
We've run out of time, Laurie. I got to say goodbye, but we'll talk more about this. Thanks for taking time. Laurie Allen, Director of Kitt Peak National Observatory in Tucson. Well, we're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about our energy future for driving. All we need is an electric vehicle in every garage, right? Well, there are consequences about that, and need to prepare for all those electric cars charging. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Earlier this month, Elon Musk said he would send his personal vehicle, that's a cherry red Tesla Roadster, as payload on SpaceX's test of its Falcon Heavy rocket next year. He's going to put his car on top of the rocket. That would make it the first electric car in space. Well, closer to home, the future seems bright for electric vehicles, too. Countries like Britain and India have announced intentions to wean themselves off fossil-fueled vehicles. Charging stations for plug-in vehicles are spreading across the U.S. Mercedes, BMW, Volkswagen, Nissan, GM, Toyota, you already know about Tesla. They're all working hard to put an electric car in your garage. But practically speaking, how close are we to an all-electric transportation future? There are lots of unknowns. For example, can our electric grid handle the shift into a total electric economy? Can the transformers and the wires on your telephone pole handle all those electric cars charging at the same time overnight? And with so many electric cars, just how long are travelers willing to wait in line for their vehicles to charge at a charging station? How long would you wait? And an age-old question, if our electric grids are still running on coal, I'm looking at you, Northeast cities, how does driving an electric vehicle help anything if you're making the electricity by burning coal? That's what we're going to talk about. If you'd like to join in the discussion, our number is 844-724-8255. You could also tweet us at SciFry, 844-724-8255. Let me introduce my guest. Jessica Trancic, Associate Professor at the Institute for Data Systems and Society at MIT, and Kara Kockelman, Professor of Transportation Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. And we'd like to hear your thoughts. As I say, what have you done to shrink your transportation footprint, and what stands in our way? Again, our number, 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at science at SciFry. That is our tweet handle. Welcome, guests, to the program.
Thank you so much.
Let me ask you first, Kara. Let's start with a look into the crystal ball. How fast is electric vehicle popularity actually growing in the U.S.?
Well, pretty well, thanks to Tesla. Really, that's an exciting vehicle for a lot of demographics. It's expensive, but thanks to their Model 3, it's now within the realm of reality for many people.
Wow. And realistically speaking, Jessica, how many of us could be driving electric vehicles but are not?
Well, many more than are driving electric vehicles today. So we've done some research on the energy consumption per day of people in cars. And on a daily basis, at least, we estimate that about 90% of cars on the road daily could be replaced by a low-cost electric vehicle and still meet the energy needs of drivers.
And what is keeping people from buying them? Is it still the cost of part? Is that part of why people aren't buying them?
Well, the thing is, if you look at, some of the low-cost electric vehicles and you take into account the cost of ownership and driving and so forth, consumers don't actually have to pay more for these cars than, you know, similar internal combustion engine vehicles. But I think there are still some concerns that people have about range. So there's something called range anxiety. And the number that I just mentioned is, you know, on a daily basis, within a single household, there may be 10% or less days where the electric car may not meet your needs. I think we need to come up with some creative solutions to that in order to increase electric vehicle adoption. Part of it is just getting information to consumers.
Yeah. Kara, do you drive an electric vehicle or are looking forward to driving one?
Well, I do drive a hybrid electric vehicle, so my Prius works great. Here in Texas, we don't get access to all of the fantastic vehicles that Californians have and maybe those in Boston like Jessica. But we did do studies of actual Americans driving for a whole year to see what's the probability that a household would not be able to complete all of its trips charging just once a day at night. And we used Seattle data that has thoughtfully instrumented over 200 vehicles for over a year. And we found very low percentages that couldn't make, you know, one trip a year. And of course, they can rent a car. And some of the manufacturers are actually providing that in the warranty on their electric vehicle sales is, don't worry, we will get you that rental car with gasoline if you need to make a long trip this year.
So what you're both saying is that this fear that people have of running out of electricity is unfounded, because 90% of where they drive, they'll have plenty of charge to go. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And that number varies. You know, if you can afford a car with a larger battery, then that number is even higher. And essentially, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of American households have two and sometimes three or more vehicles. And so if you play your cards right, you can actually just hand that vehicle to the person who really needs it. So when we do that, we see incredible, you know, completion of trips. But we also have a recent paper about those long distance trips. So looking at all of the over 50 mile trips in a year here in the United States on the ground, so in one's personal vehicle, and where would you need to place charging stations so that we could get by with a fleet that had just 100 miles of range, right? Our conventional vehicles have 400, maybe 500 miles range, but a lot of these vehicles are closer to 100, and now they're going up to 200 thanks to the Bolt and, to, of course, the Model 3.
Mm-hmm. But how long are, you know, I drive a lot on the roads, and I look at all the Tesla charging stations and the other charging stations that are there, and I'm saying, you know, there's a car there every once in a while. But if everybody starts driving an electric car, are they going to be waiting in line to get to those little charging posts? And are they willing to wait, what it might be, a half hour or so, or an hour?
Right. I think on a holiday weekend, that's when I would be concerned. I would really think carefully about what vehicle I would take. And you can get data, I'm sure, from these charging station owners, and they're anticipating that too, because they can't sell vehicles if we start getting this backlash and comments online. I mean, information travels very fast these days, thanks to the internet, about where the charging stations are filling up. So there will be probabilities, just like Google can tell us, you know, a day or a month ahead of time, if we leave at 8 a.m. for this particular trip, what do they think that the time's going to be? And we have that data. So they add to try to avoid those situations, but there will be some. And of course, we Americans only buy cars maybe every 15 or 16 years. At least that's when the scrapping occurs of a vehicle. So it's a long time to switch over a fleet.
Yeah. Well, let's say everybody gets an electric car. I mean, and they all start charging them overnight.
It's going to take at least 20 years, Ira. So, I mean, that just can't happen because of the lifetime of our existing vehicles.
No, I'm just wondering, what about, you know, the telephone pole with the transformers mm-hmm. and the wires? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be able to handle everybody charging, or do we have to start planning for that day and upgrading these things?
Well, where we already have air conditioning, yes, they can handle it because they upgraded their transformers to do that. And, of course, California is now getting so hot thanks to climate change and just people's personal preference that they've added transformers to handle AC across that state. I'm not sure about you guys in Massachusetts and New York, however.
Well, what do you say to that,
Jessica? Yeah, well, there is a lot of work going on here in Massachusetts. And I guess I just wanted to echo and sort of build on the point that Kara made, which is really important, which is to think about where we are today with less than 1% of new cars being fully electric and, you know, how far we are from the point where some of these issues really, really start to matter. Now, in some locations, they already matter. But as Kara mentioned, there are practical steps that we can take to improve our infrastructure. So it's very doable, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Callers are beginning to log in and talk about this. Yep. Let me see if I can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Tony in Chicago. Hi, Tony.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey there. Go ahead.
Love your show. Okay, so I'm an electrician, and we install these electric charging vehicle stations once in a while in homes mostly. The thing that the majority of people don't realize is that the average house draws about 20, 25 amps on an average day without an air conditioner. The smallest electric charger for a car, electric car, is about 30 amps, okay, 30 to 60 amps. So if you do the math, you're going to increase that substantially by 40 to 50%. And then at night, between 5 and 2 a.m., 3 a.m., because that's when most people are going to charge their cars, it's going to skyrocket on the grid. I mean, it's going to put a very, very heavy load on the grid. Not only that, but now you're digging up the earth more to produce yellow cake to make, you know, nuclear power. So there's a balance. You know, there's a place for both. And putting these charging stations all over the country overnight, it ain't going to happen, man.
All
it
right.
ain't going to happen.
Thanks for your expertise. What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, if I could just jump in, you know, one of the issues the caller brought up is this question of when people are plugging in and charging, you know, and there is a peak in demand around 5 p.m. in most places. But what we found with some of our research is that if you delay that by a bit, and, you know, that doesn't have to involve even smart home systems or complicated, you know, network devices, you can adopt simple rules to delay charging a bit. That can really help a lot.
Well, another question, he talked about nuclear power, but here in the Northeast, you know, there's still a lot of coal power going on. I mean, aren't we just transferring, you know, the electricity? You have a green car, but now you have dirty electricity, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up. Oh, sorry, Kara. You know, this is an issue that I'm really glad you brought that up, Ira, because there's a lot of misunderstanding around this. And, you know, we've looked at this issue carefully. And what you see is that in most cases around the country, if you switch to an electric vehicle, your emissions are reduced per mile by 30% or more. So that's a 30 to 40% emission savings in going from an internal combustion engine to an electric vehicle. And that's with today's electricity supply mix. The reason for that is that the conversion efficiency is really quite high from what we call the well to the wheel. So all the way from extracting your fuel, in the case of electric vehicles, producing electricity, and then all the way to the what's called the tractive energy that propels the car forward.
Mm-hmm. Kara?
Yeah, I think a lot of the manufacturers know all about this twin peaking issue, and so they delay typically. And, of course, the owner also has the intelligence on board the vehicle. My friend with a Volt does this all the time. You know, his vehicle just naturally delays its starting. Just because he gets home at 6 p.m., it doesn't start cycling until, I think, closer to 9 or midnight. So I'm not sure where the caller is in this country, but, you know, here in Texas, I think we have more than 30 amps a lot of the days in the summer. And, yeah, our vehicles are are waiting to charge just by manufacturer design. But of course, if you really need that vehicle full by midnight or something, you can program it to start charging. And it's very easy, I think, to do with the interface that they have. So I also want to make the point that over time, even if you're in, let's say, Pennsylvania, which I think is pretty heavy coal, and Jessica can talk about that in a bit, but even if you're charging in Pennsylvania, I think that that feedstock and that grid and those power supplies are cleaning up over time. A lot of coal plants are going offline just for economic reasons. And so these electric vehicles are getting cleaner. And again, they're going to last 15 to 16, maybe 17, 18 years for most households. And so they actually get cleaner over time while conventional vehicles get dirtier. The catalytic converters and other pieces on that engine and components are known to absolutely decay. And so they get dirtier over time while the grid is cleaning up.
Speaking of Pennsylvania, we have a caller, Joseph from Philadelphia. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the conversation today.
Go ahead.
I picked up a Chevy Bolt over the summer. I've had it now for, 4 or 5 months. And what I've found as a user, I absolutely love the vehicle. It's fantastic as a commuter car. But the infrastructure simply isn't there in the public yet. It's getting better every day. But it's not there. I've installed a level 2 charger at home. Frankly, I've used it maybe 6 times because I have access at work for no-cost charging, which is brilliant. I'm curious what folks have to say about longevity of the batteries. What I'm finding now is just in 4 months' time, and perhaps it's my driving characteristics as well as degradation over that short period of time, I see a decreased amount of range daily basis.
Thanks for the question. Let me get a call in on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Jessica, Cara, what about the batteries?
Yeah, I'd love to know how his range has degraded. Did it go from 220 miles to 200 miles? There may be kind of a strong effect at the start. I've known people with lower range vehicles to begin with that then had a lot of uncertainty in a long commute on the way home. And because of that uncertainty in range, they did have to give up on that 80-mile total range vehicle. I'm not going to mention the manufacturer here, but in his case, I'd be curious if I can imagine he's not near a lot of fast charging stations, and so he's worried there. The Tesla superchargers do charge at a high rate, but they do not service Bolts yet.
And what's under the hood is going to be important, right? As batteries improve, can you expect that the newer cars will get the better batteries?
Absolutely. They absolutely have improved.
Yeah. And just to add to Kara's point in response to the caller, what happens is often you see that manufacturers will the rated range, so the range that they publish will actually be a little bit below what that initial range is. So again, I'd love to, see the data and speak more with that particular caller. But yeah, batteries are improving, and they're improving in a couple of important ways. One is in terms of the energy density and what's called the specific energy. So that's the amount of energy stored per mass or per volume. And that allows you to basically add a bigger battery, a higher capacity battery, without adding as much weight or as much volume. And the other thing is that we're seeing a reduction in the cost per unit energy stored in batteries. And so that's a big part of what's been driving the recent trends.
One last quick question. Is the self-driving car inevitable? And how will that affect the economy of driving?
Well, yeah, I do a lot of research on that. We've got over 25 papers at my website, and it's absolutely going to affect the economy because that vehicle can take itself to the next user, and so the sharing economy can take off. And, of course, that's what the big TNCs like Uber and Lyft have in mind, and a lot of the manufacturers, of course, know this, and they're partnering or they plan to do it on their own. And Google's in the lead here, but I think it's pretty obvious. I don't want to drive. I would much rather get work done or sleep en route. I know lots of people that have better things to do en route. Driving is dangerous. It's not fun. It's actually the most dangerous thing we do, and it's one of the costliest things that we do. I mean, we're approaching $1 trillion a year in crash-related costs in this country alone. So that's thousands of dollars per capita per year in this country. So that's a great reason to make these cars smarter. At a minimum, they should stop, you know, before they hit something. Even if I don't see the obstacle, they should be connected to get a sense of where things are around them, even if they're behind a corner. There's excellent reasons to shift, and we will. I think it really takes some policy support, too, at the national level. We're not seeing that recently.
Yeah. That lets them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And if I could just add, quickly. So the other consideration, of course, is greenhouse gas emissions. And there, I think we really need to be deliberate and careful about how to harness the potential of autonomy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Because right now, it could really go either way. But there are ways to really put that to work to reducing emissions and meeting climate targets.
All right. Jessica Trancic and Kara Cockleman, thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Very interesting chatter. After the break, some clean cars.
Thanks
from
so
clean
much.
Cars to dirty money, the coal-guzzling reality of Bitcoin. Plus, are we in danger of a digital dark age? We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We were just talking about the sustainable future of driving, and now for something a bit different. What about the sustainable future of money? Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency that made it big this year, certainly may have some people seeing dollar signs and a better way to exchange value between people. But others, well, they're seeing smokestacks and coal pollution. One estimate says mining bitcoins today is consuming as much energy as the whole country of Denmark, and that could go up with the price and popularity of Bitcoin. So is the future of money dirty? My guest is Amy Nordstrom, Associate Editor at IEEE Spectrum. Welcome back, Amy.
Thanks, Ira.
Give us the numbers. How much energy does it take to mine a Bitcoin?
To mine one Bitcoin, so per transaction, it's 237 kilowatt hours, which is more than the average U.S. home consumes in an entire week. And that's the current status.
Well, why? Why does it take so much energy?
The inefficiency of Bitcoin is actually... It's a feature, not a bug. I mean, it really has to do with the security of the cryptocurrency itself. So Bitcoin is built on this data architecture called the blockchain, and that's really what keeps it secure and protected from hackers. So the way that the blockchain works is it's basically a list of transactions organized into these groups called blocks, and they make it very difficult to add new blocks to the chain. And that's what makes it hard for people to go back and edit previous transactions on the list and steal money. So in order to add these new blocks to the chain, you actually have to do some very complicated math that takes a lot of computing power. There's a particular function called a hash function that these Bitcoin miners have to perform over and over. They have to do it again and again to get the right number, and they're all trying to get the right number at the same time, because if I get it before you, I'm rewarded in Bitcoins and you lose out. So there's actually a financial incentive to put tons of computing power into mining these Bitcoins, adding more blocks to the chain and getting the rewards.
And all these thousands of computers running together, they're eating up electricity made by coal power?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah,
these Bitcoin mining operations are largely concentrated in China and other countries that are still heavily reliant on fossil fuels and also have more lax carbon emissions restrictions than countries like in Europe or in the U.S., for example.
How much more power compared to conventional currency like a credit card transaction? How does that compare?
It's thousands of times more power. There was one estimate that compared it to a Visa credit card transaction and found that a Bitcoin transaction takes about 5,000 times more energy.
So how come we're just talking about this now? Well, what brings this into the news?
Well, Bitcoin is hotter than ever. So the price of Bitcoin, one Bitcoin in U.S. dollars, was less than $1,000 at the start of this year. It reached $5,000 in October, and now it's over $17,000 per Bitcoin. So it's become hugely popular. There's more and more transactions happening every day. And the computing hardware that these miners are using is certainly getting more efficient, but the pace of transactions and the demands in computing power are perhaps going to outpace it if Bitcoin continues to take off.
Oh, so if it keeps skyrocketing, we're going to see more mining.
Yes.
More use of this dirty energy.
Absolutely,
is
yes.
Is there any green energy? I mean, does anybody talk about that?
Yeah, there's definitely other kinds of cryptocurrencies that are trying to address this problem. And there are other blockchains that are using a different scheme to add more blocks to the chain that would not require as much computing power. So the one that Bitcoin uses is called proof of work. That's the guessing over and over of this number to get the right algorithm to add a block to the chain. But there's other blockchains that are built on something called proof of stake. So that just grants permission for somebody to add a block to the chain, depending on how many coins they have invested. So it's sort of like, you know, you're not going to cheat the system because then you're actually cheating yourself. And that is supposed to make it a more sustainable and efficient blockchain.
So you're thinking there is a sustainable Bitcoin possible?
You know, it's tough with Bitcoin because it's already built on this inefficient scheme that has these scalability issues. And these new blockchains are kind of coming up and hoping to rival Bitcoin for people who want a more sustainable solution. And of course, you could run Bitcoin off of renewable energy, but that's not currently happening. So we'll have to see how this plays out. It really is a big problem for the cryptocurrency.
Yeah, well, we're glad you know about it. It's such a difficult thing for all of us to wrap our heads around.
It's difficult, but it's not going to go away anytime soon. So it's worth trying to figure it out.
All right. Keep us on your schedule, Amy.
Thanks, Ira.
Amy Nordstrom, Associate Editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. Next up, we live today in the age of digital data. Your photos, your documents, even your thoughts are housed on thumb drives in the cloud, on your laptop, or your pad. Youngsters do not have shoeboxes full of old photos. Old phonograph records now sit in boxes in the attic or the basement. But in this digital age, we might also be in more danger of losing our data. I mean, we still have those photos. We still have those records. There's no physical record now of the digital stuff that you own. Your old CDs will not last more than a couple of decades. And this worries archivists and archaeologists and presents a challenge. Are our backups backed up themselves? Science Friday's digital team has been digging into those questions, and today they've unveiled their File Not Found series. It's a three-part series. It's actually a beautiful companion website all about the past, present, and future of data storage, and you can take a look at it and listen to it at sciencefriday.com/data. sciencefriday.com/data. Science Friday's web producer, Lauren Young, was the lead reporter on that package, and she's here now with us in our New York studios. Welcome back.
Hey, Ira.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Now, the series, as I said, is very beautiful online.
Thanks.
Congratulations to you. Give us an idea what this data project is all about.
Sure. So today, a lot of our information, our memories, our lives really are saved as digital files, essentially data. So you may think that those photos on Facebook or all your tweets may last forever or maybe even come back to haunt you, depending on what you have out there. But I found out that, unfortunately, much of our digital information is at risk of disappearing in the future. And if that does happen, if our data really is lost, it could really put us in this realm called the digital dark ages. And when I was reporting the story, I talked to Rick Witt, who is at Google, and he manages the data preservation efforts there. And here's how he described it.
We may know less about the early 21st century than you do about the early 20th century, because the early 20th century is still largely based on things like paper and film formats that are still accessible to a large extent. Whereas much of what we're doing now, the things we're putting into the cloud, more of our digital content is now born digital. So it's not just something that we translated from an analog container into a digital container, but in fact has born and now increasingly dies as digital content without any kind of analog counterpart.
So going off of what Rick just said, so some experts that I spoke to have called the 21st century the time that we're living in right now as an informational black hole. So what that means is the digital information that we create right now may not be readable by like machines and programs of the future. So all that data, our eventual digital history, is at risk of being lost. And that's what we wanted to write about.
Yeah. Anybody got a floppy disk reader around anywhere? I understand exactly what you're saying.
Exactly.
And one of the stories in this series deals with something called the end of term web archive project, this sort of mad scramble, right? Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah. So at the end of every U.S. presidential term, so about every 4 years, the new administration can come in and change all of the content on government websites, the .gov domains, and there really isn't any law or regulation against this. So ever since around the Bush to Obama administration back in 2008, librarians and web archivists have been doing this big harvest of all the URLs of government websites. And it might sound like this kind of valiant superhero task to save all these data sets, right, and websites, but if you talk to one of these librarians, you'll see that it's actually not that action-packed.
The actual, like, saving the data, that's mostly a lot of people sitting at computers. So it's not very glamorous to watch.
I mean, excuse me if I'm kind of like sounding a little old and cynical. I really do say this with love. I'm very tickled that all of these hipsters now think that this is sexy work. But, you know, this is just like kind of a little mundane work sometimes also. It's like writing a lot of citations and footnotes, right?
So that was Margaret Jans, the first person and organizer at the Data Refuge Project, and Debbie Rubina, a professor at Pratt Institute School of Information. And they both helped out this past recent end-of-term URL harvesting in 2016. And while they may describe their work as kind of mundane, what they did was really valuable.
All right, so now they're scrambling to archive everything that's been on the web, but can I access all this government data that they've harvested?
Right, that's a great question. So not yet. They are currently working on making all that data accessible to the public. It was a lot of data, after all, like on the petabyte level. So they're working on it.
I'll bet it is. I'd like to bring on another guest now, a digital archaeologist herself who's worked to resurrect old digital relics, video games, virtual worlds, stuff like that for modern eyes. Kara Krauss. Kara Krauss is an associate professor in the College of Information Studies and Department of English at the University of Maryland in College Park. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you. So walk us through this problem of preserving an old artifact of digital culture. In fact, I understand that you saved an old video game called Mystery House. Oh, classic. How'd you do that?
Indeed. Yeah. So this was a game that was first launched in 1980. It was the first work of interactive fiction to include computer graphics. And so this was one of the games in our case set when we were working on the Preserving Virtual Worlds project funded by the Library of Congress. And we basically, in this project, we were interested in investigating different preservation strategies. So Mystery House was a game that we took through the different preservation routes, including hardware preservation, emulation, and migration.
And when you do this, is there sort of an attempt to make the game better? Maybe I can improve it a bit.
I mean, it's interesting that you asked that, Ira, because I would say that something like migration as a preservation practice also veers into creative reimplementation. So if you're trying to update the game, maybe recode it from an obsolete programming language like Fortran into a more modern programming language, you might be tempted to make new changes along the way. It's not unlike adapting, say, a Jane Austen novel for film, for example.
Yeah, very interesting. Lauren, if people want to play some of these old games and use these emulators, where can they do that?
The Internet Archive. The Internet Archive is really great. They have something called an Internet Arcade, among many other types of cool stuff on there. It's this basically a place with a website with 1970s to 1990s video games. So you can go and play Astro Blaster and Mr. Do and Tron. And I geeked out when I saw that you could actually play Oregon Trail on the Internet Archive, which is really great. And those are all emulators, and it's totally public access.
Now, Carrie, I understand that you have also worked to save virtual worlds like Second Life, where we had a lot of real estate.
That's what I've heard, Ira. And yeah, that was the trickiest case study that we had. I would say to a large degree, it was a failure. We ran into a lot of technical and legal problems with Second Life. We basically took sort of several islands in Second Life. So as you know, Second Life uses the geography metaphors like islands to visualize the world. And so we experimented with Democracy Island, Stanford University Libraries, and a few others. And some of the problems we ran into is, first of all, Second Life gives intellectual property ownership to its creators or its residents, as its players are called. And so we first had to inventory all of the content on an island, then create a donor agreement that we had to we had to track down the residents of Second Life who were active in these islands and see if they'd be willing to sign a donor agreement that would allow us to copy their content and export it out of the world.
My hair is hurting already. It's all that paperwork. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about archiving the internet with Lauren Young and Carrie Krause. And Lauren, the first part of your series deals with a storage medium that is certainly near and dear to my heart, and that is magnetic tape. I understand it's come a long way.
Definitely has come a long way. So actually, a single cartridge of the tapes today can hold hundreds of terabytes of data, and that's equivalent to hundreds of millions of books, really. And actually, this past summer, IBM increased the amount that you can hold on a cartridge to 330 terabytes, which is 330,000 gigabytes per cartridge. It's a lot of data.
So that is the long-term storage of choice. Google still uses it as backup.
Absolutely, yeah. So big companies like Google, particle physics labs like Fermilab, all have these big, massive libraries of tape with thousands and thousands of cartridges there.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Kari, what about bit rot? You know, the bits go away on the tape. Is it still an issue with the way we store data today? Or is it an artifact from old-fashioned kinds of tape?
Yeah, I mean, different storage media have different lifespans, right? So in our case, in our project, we worked a lot with magnetic media like floppy disks. And those only have a lifespan of, say, 10 to 14 years. Optical media like DVDs and CD-ROM, I believe, even less. So, yeah, bit rot is going to be a problem across different storage media.
Mm-hmm. And Lauren, what you also write about some of the data storage devices of the future. Let's look into our crystal ball.
Right, yeah. Actually, interestingly enough, a lot of the researchers that I spoke to and sources that I spoke to kept referring back to DNA storage, which is something that we've talked about before on the show. But basically, researchers have found a way to store data onto DNA, which is, you know, this billion-year-old molecule that can store the essence of life. So it's pretty incredible that they can do that.
But you can't read it too quickly. It's not an instant storage system.
Right.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely.
So I'm not carrying around a test tube of DNA instead of my thumb drive with me.
Yeah, it's all synthetically made, so it's not genomic DNA or anything like that.
And one last question, Kari. Do you think to some extent this fear of losing all our data is just analogous to, you know, losing documents in fires and things like that? We've always lost data, haven't we?
We have, and I cannot make up my mind whether I think the phrase digital dark ages is overblown or not. Because as you know, Ira, I mean, we have architectural ruins. We have paintings in tatters. So the past always survives in fragments already. And so I don't know. I guess I tend to see preservation as not a binary. Either it's preserved or it's not. There are gradations of preservation. We can often preserve parts of larger wholes. So I see, within the video game community, I see a lot of success in terms of the fan community and game enthusiasts. They're doing a lot of the hard work, and we're sort of riding on their coattails.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you, because, you know, we've all trying to upgrade our digital data so it doesn't get lost. And I wish you good luck. And thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, Kari.
Thanks for having me. And again, congratulations on the project.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kari Krause is an associate professor in the College of Information Studies and the Department of English at the University of Maryland in College Park. And thank you, Lauren. Great website.
Thanks. Yeah. And you guys can all read it at sciencefriday.com/data, which was also the microsite was designed by our great digital producer, Daniel Peterschmidt. So check it out.
There you go. Lauren Young is Science Friday's web producer. And as I said, you can read all three parts at sciencefriday.com/data. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Our technical and engineering help today from Rich Kim, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz. And we are active all week on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the social media. You can hear us on your Amazon Echo, if you ask it the right way, and also your Google Home will play Science Friday. So every day is now Science Friday. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.